Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. So whether you're tuning in live right now or catching up later, stay ahead with some of the stories that really matter. Coming up, the Transport Minister on standby to talk to us on the air traffic navigation services crisis. Did he overstep or didn't he? The big debate continues to rage around the booting out of South Africa's ambassador to the United States, Ibrahim Rasool. The property market outlook ahead of the Monetary Policy Committee's rates announcement tomorrow, and new research that's looking at the potential of rooibos in mitigating the harmful effects of petrochemicals among petrol attendants. Let's start with this, and the state-owned Air Traffic Navigation Services is asking the Civil Aviation Authority for an extension on 31 flight procedures that expire on the 10th of April. If not granted, flights will be affected. Now, according to the Minister of Transport, Barbara Creasy, 66 of 300 flight procedures are set to expire, affecting, among others, OR Tambo International, Cape Town International, Kinshasa and Lanseria. They can expire or become outdated due to factors like regulatory updates from aviation authorities or changes in airspace, such as new restrictions, navigation aids or simple route adjustments. I'm in conversation now with Minister Creasy. Minister, thank you very much indeed. At a news conference earlier this week, you confirmed that critical skill shortages, equipment failures and outdated procedures at ATNS have contributed to the flight delays and cancellations that we've seen recently. You also went on to say, if I heard you correctly, that intervention is now required. What is that intervention? And when's it going to happen?
Greetings, Jeremy, to you and all your listeners. Well, as you probably know, I appointed an intervention team to do an analysis in December. They gave me the report early in January. We then established four work streams. So a lot of the important things that need to be done are already underway. For example, on the skills issue, we advertised earlier this year. We are making offers to 13 highly skilled people that would include flight procedure designers and air traffic controllers and navigators this week. We've already brought two people on board who are now at undergoing the validation process. We are in consultation with the OEMs to upgrade our equipment, and we also want to make sure that our radio systems are in good nick by the end of March. A lot of progress has been made on establishing all the safety management systems that have been outstanding for a long period of time. But the sticky point is what you said in the introduction, the flight procedures. And there has been progress on the development of these flight procedures, but what is outstanding are the charts. These are obviously complicated technical designs. We have brought in two flight procedure designers who are working, but because of the complicated nature of the charts that are required, we won't be finished all of them by the 10th of April. Yesterday, there was a meeting with the Civil Aviation Authority. There was an action plan put before them, but they've requested further work to be done. So I'm not in a position at this point to indicate whether or not we will get a renewal of the alternative means of compliance. And as you say, this is something that is of deep concern to us, because it can mean that in bad weather, we would have to have flight delays.
Minister, what do you say to the outgoing Airlink Chief Executive Officer, Roger Foster, who's been scathing in his criticism? He says that ATNS's board and top management have no idea of the scale of the crisis. He goes on to say it's not merely for airlines and their passengers, this problem, but for the national economy as well.
I actually read his statement, and I think that our own intervention team has analysed the areas of weakness that he refers to. You would know that I did order the board to suspend the CEO and conduct an investigation on her role in these failures. And I think that he is correct when he says this is a very serious situation. And it as he correctly indicates, not only impacts on individual passengers and airlines, but of course, aviation is a very important economic sector. And we would not want to see further delays and grounding of flights because, as they say, time is money. And all of these things impact on our growth trajectory.
Minister, the criticism is that all of this is moving too slowly. Many industry experts are saying that ATNS is now a serious safety risk, and there are guarantees that are needed that passenger safety is optimum at this point. Can you guarantee that?
Well, I think this is why we are working so closely with the Civil Aviation Authority, because they are the regulator and the custodian of safety. And it is the reason why I don't want to take shortcuts. I think that safety is the most important issue. Our country has a good safety record. And if we have to have delays rather than an accident, I think that we all know what the choice would be. But I would be able to answer more in terms of whether or not we will have those delays once the Civil Aviation Authority gives us a final ruling. But let me say that safety is my number one concern, and I'm not going to push the Civil Aviation Authority to do anything that could compromise airline safety in any way.
If that ruling is delayed, would you be happy to fly with your family post the 10th of April on a flight in South Africa?
Jeremy, I fly four times a week, every week. And let me say, first of all, that if there are delays, it doesn't mean that planes cannot fly legally and safely. What it means is if there were to be bad weather, they can't use instrument procedures. And we all understand that instrument procedures are a very important mitigating measure if there is bad weather. So obviously, if there were to be bad weather, then planes would not be allowed to take off because that would compromise safety. If there isn't bad weather, then planes can fly on manual procedures. But of course, what we want to try and ensure is that the relevant safety procedures are there so that we can continue to fly the instrument procedures which we are flying legally at the moment.
Do you think this fiasco has damaged South Africa's global aviation standing?
I take this situation extremely seriously. It's why I appointed an intervention team. It's why I have been meeting with the ATNS management and board every 2 weeks. It's why I am meeting weekly with the intervention team, because I am fully aware of the risks that are involved in this situation and the need to resolve it appropriately and speedily.
What a lot of people, Minister, find extraordinary is that airlines have been sounding the alarm on this issue for such a long time. And the sense is, and I acknowledge that this might be prior to your appointment, but the sense is still is that there was little action coming from the government that you now serve in.
You know, Jeremy, I can only account for since I've been there. And I can say to you that I have been dealing with this situation since a Sunday morning that was 10 days after my appointment. And I have been dealing with it with consistency and regularity. We've also had regular meetings with the airline industry on all of the measures that we're taking to deal with this situation. And I will continue to do that until the matter is resolved, as long as I'm in this position.
And Minister, finally, on a slightly different issue, are you concerned that SAA pilots are about to go on strike?
Well, I have been in contact this morning with the CEO of SAA. At the moment, there are plans for meetings. He has not indicated to me that a strike is imminent at this stage, but obviously I am paying close attention to that matter, and I am in constant contact with him on the processes of interaction between the SAA management and the airline pilots.
Minister Barbara Creasy, Transport Minister, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, diplomats are meant to be measured, careful, and even strategic. But what happens when an ambassador maybe says too much? Well, you know what I'm talking about. Ibrahim Rasool's removal from his post in Washington has sparked a degree of controversy, some calling it justified, others arguing it was a politically motivated overreaction. I want to explore all of this in a little more detail now with Patrick Lukasa Kadima from the Wits Business School here in Johannesburg. He is an international law specialist. Patrick, a very warm welcome to you. So what is your view? Did he break diplomatic decorum and speak out of turn? What's your sense? What's your analysis?
Hi, Jeremy, and hi to your listeners. So essentially, we should look first to what diplomats or what diplomacy entails, right? So an ambassador is a diplomat, and they are governed by the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations, which is one of the oldest treaties in international law. And this treaty guides us and tells us, especially in Article 41, that diplomats should not interfere, right, with politics or internal affairs of the host state, right? It does not prohibit this fully or, you know, expressly, but it emphasizes that diplomats should not interfere in matters of the host state, internal affairs of the host state. Mm. So here we have the ambassador who said his comments on a webinar, right, that was happening here in Johannesburg. And, you know, his statements obviously, you know, were correct, but should they have been said by an ambassador? I don't think so. I don't think so, because custom and practice dictates that he should not have said those things. You know, whether they're correct or they're false, at the end of the day, he should not have done that. He should have left it for, you know, politicians, the minister, the president, to utter those words.
So, however egregious this may sound, the US was probably right then to be angry and insist on his departure.
No, yes, they were angry, but to insist on his departure, that's a radical remedy to take, right? There are various remedies that a country or state can take rather than expelling an ambassador for those comments. You call in an ambassador, you explain to him, you ask him to explain what he meant by those statements rather than expelling him. So they were waiting for the right moment, given the tensions between South Africa and the United States of America, to be able to expel him. And, you know, it's not the first time we'd have former American ambassador here, as you know, who had commented on the, you know, the Russian ship and so on and so forth, and said we'd put arms into that ship and so on and so forth. I mean, South Africa never expelled him, right? They never took that radical remedy. They called him in for him to explain his comments, right? And then that's when the government had released the statement and so on and so forth. So even America itself has had an ambassador in Germany during Trump's administration, right? The first Trump administration, where he started meddling in affairs of Germany, right? The internal affairs of Germany. And they had to remind him that you are an ambassador, and the meaning of ambassador in German is, I think, Botschafter, you know, meaning messenger. And you're not supposed to be meddling in internal affairs of the state, right? So we have seen this happen many times, and I think the radical remedy is not expelling an ambassador. It is calling in an ambassador and asking him to explain his statement.
So an overreaction then, but do you think this signals possibly a broader shift now in US-SA relations, or as someone or some have suggested, maybe just a minor blip? That certainly seems to be the message that's coming out of the South African government and the presidency.
I don't think it can be said to be a minor blip. The expulsion of an ambassador What does it entail? It means that we're cutting the diplomatic relations between a country, right? We're expelling your ambassador, right? This is the highest ranking official of a country in another country, right? And when you expel one, it means that there is a frosty relationship. I don't think, I mean, maybe theoretically, you know, it shows that the diplomatic relations between two countries are at an all-time low, you know, but maybe in practicality it means something different, but I don't think so. I mean, expulsion of an ambassador is a very big thing. I mean, we just saw it, I think, a day back or two, where Belgium and Rwanda were both expelling each other's ambassadors, and, you know, and so on and so forth. So I think it signals that the relationship is at an all-time low, and that they need to, and I don't think it's South Africa's fault. I mean, it's the Trump's administration that, you know, has brought itself here.
How does South Africa fix this?
It's a very difficult one, but I'm of the view that it is important that the president, you know, appoints an envoy. You know, the envoy has been speaking about at a very fast pace, so that they can go to Washington and try to mediate and try to seek a common ground how the relationships can be restored. Because, I mean, it is important that, you know, the American government and South Africa's relationship is restored, because there are too many benefits that can, you know, can be of advantage to both countries.
But it's extraordinary that South Africa appears to be dragging its feet in that respect in trying to mend that fence.
No, I think, you know, to say that it is dragging its feet might be, you know, I think overemphasizing it or over-exaggerating it. I mean, given, you know, there is a difference between diplomacy in practice and diplomacy in theory, right? And, you know, when such actions are taken and you have a Trump administration that's so focused on, you know, misinformation, you need to be able to have the right people, you know, that will be able to go there. You know, the appointment of right people, I think, also boils down to the issue that maybe it's time that in South Africa we look at, you know, developing a more career diplomats, if I may put it that way, you know, instead of political diplomats, right? Political in the way that, you know, if you maybe you're a former minister and now you have lost your seat, or, you know, you are sent to a post. I think we need to start developing our diplomatic service in such a way that, you know, we have career diplomats, you know, that understand where to toe the line, you know, because I think also that might be, you know, something we need to look at.
And I'm going to leave it there. Patrick Lukasa Kadima from the Wits Business School, appreciate your time today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, a possible interest rate cut this week has property investors, I imagine, somewhat hopeful. But if it happens, is it enough to revive the market? And perhaps more importantly, are we generally being too optimistic about the impact of lower rates? Herschel Javits is with us now. He's the Chief Executive Officer of Javits Properties, and he's going to weigh in with some thinking. So, Herschel, first of all, let's talk about tomorrow. What's the conventional wisdom? Do you think we're going to see any downward movement in rates tomorrow?
Jeremy, I'm not sure that I have the wisdom of the economists or the Reserve Bank, but it would seem to me, if you look at all of the indicators, inflation is still below the midpoint, the rand is strengthened, oil prices are low, demand inflation, which is always a key driver of the decision, is almost non-existent in South Africa. But it would seem that this global uncertainty is creating all sorts of challenges. And so it's going to be a very, very tight call. The last call was a 4-2 vote to drop rates. I think this time it's going to be much closer. And I do expect possibly that the Reserve Bank is going to err on the side of caution.
What impact is this global uncertainty having on investor sentiment when it comes to property purchase?
Interestingly, over the last 6 months or so, almost post the election and the outcome of the election, which I think was viewed favorably, together with the beginning of the interest rate cutting cycle, the lowering of inflation, the elimination, even if for a couple of months, of load shedding, lots of positive signals. And we've seen, for the most part, an increase, a meaningful increase in buyer sentiment, buyer demand and activity in the market. And really, demand in the residential property market is driven by two factors, affordability and sentiment. And both have improved, albeit at different levels. So I think to a large degree, people who are looking to buy a home in South Africa are not necessarily worried about what's happening with AGOA and what's happening with Donald Trump. They're looking to buy their first home. They have a family. They're looking for a garden. They're potentially looking to retire or buy a holiday home. So I don't think in the residential market the global uncertainty is impacting. And you only have to look as far as the Western Cape to see the influence of foreign buying to understand that South Africa and its prices, both locally and internationally, remain a very attractive investment.
So would you say then that we are now seeing a sustained recovery in buyer demand, or is this just a temporary sentiment?
There's no doubt from an affordability point of view that affordability is improving, and we're seeing better activity in that first-time buyers market as well, layered with the marginal reduction in transfer duties. Fuel prices have generally come down. So we're seeing the affordability improving only if marginally. And at the middle and top end of the market, sentiment seems to be better. But as we well know, sentiment is fickle. So I think the sustained increase in affordability, I think, is there, but consumer confidence is fickle and it can change on a dime. But for the moment, and for the last couple of months, we have seen a sustained increase in demand and activity, and I would expect that to continue.
You talk about marginal affordability, and I think that is a key phrase. How much of the market, then, in your opinion, is still being held back by affordability constraints, even if we have seen lower rates and possibly throughout the rest of the year, we might see further movement in that respect?
I think where we see that typically is in that first-time buyer's market. So if you look at post-COVID, interest rates plummeted to 7%. The buy versus rent decision at 7% was an easier decision to make. And we saw lots of first-time buyers coming into the market, cheaper to pay off a R1 million mortgage than to rent a one or a two a one or two bedroom home. And as interest rates have climbed, we've seen that sort of turning on its head. So as interest rates come down, that marginal affordability does improve, and together with petrol prices and lower inflation, if you can believe our inflation rates when you're actually in the aisles of supermarkets. So it all layers, but generally the direction of affordability is positive. And if you combine that once again also with the bank lending environment, so the bank lending environment is extremely competitive. Banks are fighting for a larger slice of a smaller pie, and the rate concessions from your major retail banks are probably the best they've been in a decade.
Just a final one. Do you think sometimes we overstate the role of interest rates in this dynamic when I would suggest confidence in the economy is a far bigger factor?
Absolutely, Jeremy. I mean, I think affordability hits you in the back pocket. And you only have to look at Joburg versus Cape Town as an example. The immigration trend and the move to Cape Town and the Cape Town market has much less to do with sea views and mountain views and wine estates as it does to do with confidence in infrastructure, confidence in local government, and your ability to get from A to B without potholes and with traffic lights in order. So, absolutely.
Thank you very much for talking to me. That's Herschel Javits, Chief Executive Officer, Javits Properties. Always appreciate your time and your insight.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, petrol attendants are exposed to harmful petrochemicals daily, but there's a new study that suggests that the rooibos could help mitigate the damage. But I'm wondering if this is a scientific breakthrough or maybe just some wishful thinking. Let's put that under the microscope. I'm in conversation now with Dr. Kerry Wilson from the Institute for Occupational Health. Dr. Wilson, a very warm welcome to you. So rooibos has antioxidants in it for sure, but at this point, is there concrete evidence that it can neutralize petrochemical exposure?
So the way an antioxidant would work in terms of petrochemical exposure is more that particularly your BTEX constituents of petrol cause oxidative stress in the body. And so by supplementing with affordable antioxidants, we're hoping that some of the damage caused by the petrochemical exposure may be mitigated.
Are you able to tell us what kind of impact there is? What sort of damage is caused to people with constant exposure?
So we have two types of exposure to petrol. There's immediate effects from high-level acute exposure, which can result in headaches, dizziness, airway irritation, and even lead people to pass out or end up in a coma. Then there's long-term lower-level exposure, which is what we're more interested in. And this has been linked to respiratory diseases, hematological disorders, liver changes in liver and kidney function, and even cancers.
So, Dr. Wilson, how was the actual link made to rooibos then? How did you connect, or how were those two dots connected?
So a fair bit of research has been done on rooibos and its antioxidant properties and other properties and some of the bioactive compounds in rooibos. So when we were looking for an affordable, accessible means to increase antioxidants in the average person's diet, we came across rooibos, and we particularly chose rooibos because it doesn't have caffeine. So we don't have to worry about people perhaps that have heart conditions.
More broadly, would it not be more effective to focus on reducing exposure if that can be done rather than looking at the rooibos solution?
In general, yes. The Occupational Hygiene Control Pyramid puts replacing the substance at the top. Obviously, this is not possible. Then controls and administrative controls, and finally we get to PPE and perhaps things like supporting the immune system. But what you've got to remember here is that we're looking at quite low levels. So it becomes much more complicated to control low levels of exposure than perhaps issuing respirators for high levels of exposure.
How far down the line is the research at the moment? And the reason why I'm asking that question is, at this point, is there any risk in promoting rooibos right now as a protective agent without perhaps more conclusive longer-term studies?
So we're in the last phase of sample collection, where we will be comparing oxidative stress and antioxidant status in our petrol attendants before we supplied them with rooibos tea and after. The antioxidant potential and its anti-inflammatory potential of rooibos tea has been well established. So on the one hand, it can be recommended without the findings of our study. But on the other hand, there's not a lot of research supporting how much rooibos to drink, how frequently to drink the rooibos to see an effect. And this is partly what we're hoping to identify. But yes, there still is a great need for further larger studies and in larger groups before we can go ahead and recommend it as an occupational health tool.
So if it works, though, down the line, it would be possible that rooibos is classified as a bona fide occupational health intervention, which I guess is good news.
Yes. And beyond occupational health, it could also then be used in general situations where people live in highly polluted areas.
I'm interested to know whether the fuel companies themselves have shown any interest in this research or simply being ignored. Are they part of the equation at this time?
At this stage, no. But some of the fuel companies are aware of the study, as we did communicate with them at the start that the study was being undertaken. But as the study is being conducted in individually owned petrol stations, we didn't require permission from the fuel companies to conduct the study.
And just finally then, if the findings maybe prove inconclusive at this point, given that you said more work is still being done, what is the next step then? Would the idea be abandoned or just simply refined?
I think it definitely would need to be refined. But there is also other ongoing work looking at rooibos in different populations. Ours is just one of the first studies to look at it in an occupational setting.
I'm going to leave it there. Dr. Kerry Wilson, thank you very much indeed for that insight from the Institute for Occupational Health. I appreciate your time. And that is all from MoneyWeb at midday today. We are back tomorrow live at noon and then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.